You're listening to Lips LA with Scott Lips.
Hey, it's Scott Lips, and welcome back, my friends, to another exciting episode of Spin Magazine's Lip Service. I'm excited for our next guest. He's a Grammy-nominated Irish singer-songwriter, known best for his breakthrough self-titled 2014 debut. You know him from such songs as Take Me to Church, which is six times platinum, Someone New, and Work Song, his poetic lyricism and bluesy folk sound, whose forthcoming junior album, Unreal Unearthed, is out this past Friday, August 18th. Welcoming to the show in just a moment, Hozier.
You're listening to Lips LA with Scott Lips.
Today's episode of the show is brought to you by the all-new DLZ Creator from Mackie. The DLZ Creator is an adaptive digital mixer designed for podcasting and streaming, and it's what I'm using right now to make this podcast. What makes it so special? DLZ's mix agent technology takes all the hard parts out of making your podcast. With three selectable user modes from easy to enhanced to professional, DLZ allows creators of any experience level to make content on their own terms. It is easy. It is amazing. If you are a podcast user, you need this thing right away in Podcast Creator. With features like Setup Assistant, Auto Mix, Mackie has taken 30 years of audio legacy and packed all their expertise into a podcasting mixer that is not only top of the line, but incredibly easy to use. I can attest to that. I'm using it right now. I love it. You can find out more about DLZ Creator at Mackie.com. Check it out, the DLZ Creator by Mackie.
You're listening to Lips LA with Scott Lips.
Welcome into the show, the amazing Andrew Hozier Byrne. How are you, my friend?
I'm good. Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for coming in. What's the weirdest pronunciation of your name you've ever heard?
Ooh, I mean, I've heard a lot. One guy called me Declan Stevenson once.
Is that the wrong podcast?
Yeah, so I got a lot of, you get a lot of Hoziers, you get a lot of Hoziers, you know. You go to France, it is originally a French name. So over there, it's Hozier. So,
That's the French pronunciation.
That's French. And then it was Anglicanized somewhere. But yeah.
What about you hear all these names on TikTok, Bog Daddy, Forest God. Where do those come from? Some of them kind of relate back to Irish literature, right?
I don't know. I have a lot of fans who kind of just associate me with them. I think as I disappear a lot, I don't keep too much of a social media presence all that much. So when I'm away between album cycles, they fill that negative space with
stuff.
Yeah.
There's probably no paparazzi in Ireland, right? When you're there, it's really you being alone by the seashore. And
yeah, I don't think there really is much of it, There really isn't. Yeah.
I heard this great story about the pandemic and how you spent your time. You were taking care of bees. You were swimming. Mm. You were living your best life. And
yeah.
It's got to be very, very quiet living over there, I assume.
I enjoy it. I really do. Yeah. And especially in the pandemic, I mean, I was given a chance to spend more time there than I had in a long time. So just to kind of plug back into that local community a bit more and just do my thing was nice.
Well, we're going to get into the new record, which was made during the pandemic. It's definitely not a pandemic record. Let's make that clear for sure. But your history, how you grew up. Talk to me about life growing up in Ireland, what it was like, and your mom and dad, and kind of music all around you at that point, what it was like for you.
Yeah. I think when I was a kid, when I was still a child, we kind of moved further out into the countryside. I know music was always kind of, you don't really realize it as a kid, but music was always part of it. My dad had been a gigging drummer, was like a gigging musician before he sort of went a bit more 9 to 5 after he had a bunch of kids,
Kind of a blues musician, right?
Yeah, but he was particularly with rhythm and blues music and kind of like rock and roll. So at the time, 60s and 70s, it would have been huge. There was a huge kind of interest in blues. Obviously, like in the UK and in Ireland, guitarists like Rory Gallagher, he kind of represents that generation's sort of studying and recreating of a lot of the sort of blues music of here in America. But there was blues music always playing in the house, soul music and rock music always playing in the house, he was a huge David Bowie fan. Also, he was a huge kind of Peter Gabriel fan. So it was always an eclectic mix. And then we moved out to the countryside. And so, yeah, it kind of narrows the influences of apart from what music was kind of being played in the house. And so I had this, I guess that's something I sort of channeled later on. It's like, I lived a bit more in the outdoor spaces and enjoyed that. But it was, yeah, it was quiet. It was quiet, you know, it was, I don't know how to describe it. As a teenager, I was always able to sing as a kid. You know, I always had a voice. I didn't like singing as a kid.
I was going to say a bit reluctantly, right? You almost didn't want to sing early on.
No, I was always the kid who could sing a little bit. So you're being pressured into singing at church services. You're being pressured into singing at school events by the teacher or whatever. And it just feels weird. You know, here's words, here's a song you've no relationship with. And then you're kind of put in front of into a crowd of strangers, and then it just gawk at you while you sing a song. It never felt good. But then as I grew older, I gained an interest in music, and I started singing songs that I actually enjoyed and cared about and found my own voice in that. Started teaching myself how to play guitar, and slowly but surely teaching myself how to write music, I guess, and gained a new sort of personal relationship with it that was really significant, I guess, at the time.
And who were some of the artists you were listening to early on? I know Tom Waits was a big influence on you, but
Tom Waits was a big one. When I was maybe 15 or 16, I guess, I joined, like, myself and my brother was playing drums at the time, and we joined a bunch of musicians who were kind of from the local area who also had an interest in primarily soul music, jazz music. And at 15 or so, I joined a group of musicians. They needed a vocalist. So these bunch of 18-year-olds who were just about to go into college. And so that was fun. I was a vocalist for this kind of covers band. We just used to cover soul music. So I discovered new stuff through them, like Captain Beefheart and probably a little bit more of Tom Waits through them and jazz music through some of those players. And so, yeah, I was really interested in, like, voices in particular, I guess, hearing Otis Redding for the first time, Aretha Franklin. There's certain blues voices and blues players, and John Lee Hooker, I was fixated on for a while. Guys like Skip James, obviously Robert Johnson. And the first, I'd kind of learned how to play a few chords on guitar, but then getting to know one of the guitar players in this band, he showed me how to tune a guitar to an open chord. He gave me my first slide. And then I kind of came back to playing guitar as a 15-year-old, trying to learn, like, Robert Johnson songs and stuff like that. So it was,
By the way, a hard artist to learn at 15, right? Such an incredible guitar player.
Yeah, it was nuts. Yeah, it is nuts. But you kind of start slow, and you just you're just trying to figure out the fifth and seventh fret, and then the 12th fret, and you're finding little runs here and there.
Do you remember your first performance that you did?
With that band, we used to show up to these kind of like DIY shows, like these like DIY skater goth and emo kind of kids who were like from the area. We'd show up to there, and we wanted to, like, we'd show up in suits that we'd get from, you know, like thrift stores or Salvation Army type stores, and we'd try to look the part. And so those are the kind of first shows, these school halls where kids would just come in and set up amplifiers and do these kind of grungy sort of like, yeah, rocker gigs and goth kind of gigs.
I think AC/DC was one of the first songs you played, right?
AC/DC, yeah. That is actually probably true. Yeah. I think AC/DC was like a school concert of some kind. I was maybe, whatever, 14. But I did play an AC/DC song with a bunch of kids in my class, yeah.
Was there a scene locally growing up? Was it just pubs and high schools and things like that? Or was there actually a scene in Ireland when you were growing up?
I think as I was growing up, there would have been in Dublin, out of my access, sort of out of reach to me, you would have had a singer-songwriter scene, the likes of Damien Rice, etc.
Sure.
You know, Declan O'Rourke, all of these fantastic singer-songwriters were probably finding their way and in that sort of Whelan's Dublin scene. Glenn Hansard, the lead singer at The Frames. So that would have been taking shape, and that would have been in the space, Lisa Hannigan, et cetera, while I was maybe 15, 16. But when I was a kid, 12, 13, it was very local, kind of kids just doing that DIY, like
grunge.
Backyard grunge gig, yeah. Type thing. And so we were always these kind of odd kids showing up in these ill-fitting suits and then just with a brass section of three kids.
Amazing.
And I enjoyed it because I was 15 and I was hanging out with 18-year-olds. So I was like, had my first beer with them and stuff like that, whatever age I was. And it was good fun. So that was formative in a way. You know, that was, I got to hear a lot of new music. I got to sing in front of crowds as a kid and make sense of that. And Yeah, and deep in my relationship with music myself, and I was kind of writing at the time. You, when you're teaching yourself how to play an instrument, you maybe learn how to play a song, you gain access to new chords,
yeah,
and then eventually those find their way into a song that you're kind of writing. And yeah, so it was still countryside. It was like you take a, you know, you wait an hour for a bus, you know, and you know.
You end up dropping out of college, right? And did you tell your parents, you know, this is it, this is what I want to do with my life, music seems to be calling me? Were they encouraging you, or were they saying to you, you know what, at least finish college, Andrew, because you got to get through this?
Yeah, I think there was some reluctance on their part to be fully like thumbs up on that.
To be fair, that makes sense, right?
Makes absolute sense, right? Yeah. I had some demos, and I remember at the time I was kind of like, used to just throw loads of demos with my manager, Caroline Downey. I was always throwing demos at him. And I remember some demos got into a record label in Ireland. One of the reasons that encouraged me out of dropping out, I was given some studio time. They were like, let's put you in studio, let's see what happens, you know. But that studio schedule aligned with, or sorry, I should say, interfered with or overlapped with my Christmas exams for a year in college. And I asked if I could defer those exam times. They were like, no, you can't do that. I asked if I could go off the book for a year and see what happens. And if they'd keep my place, they said, no, you can't do that. So I said, fine, you know, I'll do this. I'll burn my boats and keep moving forward.
What was your major?
What was my major? Oh, it was just music. Yeah,
okay,
it was music.
So you were
theory.
Studying music.
I was studying music, yeah.
It's such a great story because you end up recording Take Me to Church. You can't even find a bass player. Because nobody was around, I guess. You were calling up friends to perform.
Yeah.
And it was like, nobody was available. Yeah. Imagine now the ones that you called that weren't available at the time. They must be like, I wish I was around on that day when I got that call, right?
Yeah, it is kind of funny. And it's something that I think, I laugh about still with Alex, is that Alex Ryan is my current bass player. And he was in college at the time. He stuck it out, you know, and God bless him. He's such a wonderful mind for harmony and theory. That morning I was like calling him because getting to the studio with Rob Kerwin was like I had a few days notice or a week's notice or something like that. It was quite short and I wasn't sure what exactly the plan was going to be. Just went in with the demos. But I ended up playing piano on Church, and I ended up, and the other songs on like Angel of Small Deaths, which is one of the first songs we recorded, I think I ended up playing bass on it. Because your college friends are, you know, it's college. People are asleep till noon. They're asleep till 1 p.m.
Or 4 p.m.
Or 4 p.m. You know, they're in college. So I remember calling in my buddies and I couldn't get anybody in to do the session. So I just ended up playing a lot more on those first few songs than I would have normally. But.
And literally like your second TV appearance was Letterman. I mean, who would have thought, right? You start recording this record. At that point, how did you work up to your deal with Ruby Works?
They gave us, we had been working on some stuff. They gave us just good rein, you know, they just trusted the demos, and something shifted for me in those demos. I just started writing music that felt right to me. I sort of cut myself loose from the expectations of, okay, well, what do I think people want to hear? You know, and I was just like, this is what sounds good to me right now. This is what feels good to me right now. And I had this four songs, and I think it was Take Me to Church. I think it was a song called Angel of Small Death, Like Real People Do. And I think Cherry Wine was the first EP. And I just had produced those demos as best I could and put all the vocal harmonies down and put all the feeling and the atmosphere down with whatever rudimentary knowledge I have of like working with a DAW, you know. And they just put me with Rob Kerwin, wonderful producer from Ireland. And he just took the best out of it. And we deepened it and expanded the sound a little bit, and Ruby Works were just they just gave me the space I needed and gave me the support I needed at that time to sort of see that sound through, and that sound ended up becoming that first album, and things just really accelerated incredibly fast. We released that song, and the video was directed by a group of cinematographers from County Cork, from Cork City, Brendan Canty. A group called Feel Good Lost was his creative company. I think he's still making films. And on a super small shoestring budget, this group of comedians that he knew called the Derry Nane Robot Club, they played all of the main roles in that Take Me to Church video. And it came together in this way, and it captured a lot of hearts and minds. The video the video was back when Reddit was like a Reddit was like, you know, really
was a thing, yeah.
Was a real thing.
Because actually Reddit helped the song really blow up at that point.
In that first day, yeah. In that first few days, it was like, I remember sitting in a kind of the bar that we'd frequent as students and just being like, wow, this is kind of wild. This is actually, you know. And then we would see that the song was being Shazammed on like places, you know, I wouldn't have dreamt of it being heard. I was like an indie, like I was unknown in Ireland entirely. You know, like I had never played that song on a stage at that point. It was like, you know, straight out the gate. And then soon after it was being Shazammed on like Alabama Mountain Radio and stuff like that. It was like, or it was being played on, like we were seeing it pop up on radio stations here in the States. And so yeah, things accelerated very fast.
When you write a song like that, Andrew, which becomes like this global hit, I think it's at like 2 billion streams at this point, you have a sentiment it's going to do well. But did you have any idea that song would become what it became today?
I don't think so. I remember writing that song, coming to the end of writing it and feeling proud of it, being excited for the song. But it's that sort of way that you kind of feel like you're excited for, you're kind of a, you're watching something being made and you're watching something come to itself and come to fruition. And there's that weird feeling. You're like a parent, kind of like just being proud of a kid nearly.
Yeah, because they're all your children.
They're all your children in a way. Yeah. You know, every song you write. Yeah. I was proud of it. I thought that I hoped that it would resonate with people, but I thought it would be a very, very small audience, that it might be appreciated by an Irish audience. Like at the time I was hoping, you know, if I could sell out very, very small shows, I didn't even have a band together. So I didn't have aspirations at that moment to be like, okay, well, I'll tour this or I'll promote this, etc. It was just, I was completely unknown. So yeah, I thought it might be appreciated. I was proud of it. I thought other people might see where the song was coming from and it might be appreciated by a very, very small group of people. But not to the extent that it became, you know.
And now years later, you have this incredible team around you. But initially, if the music just moved you, was that all that you were looking for? Just to inspire you personally?
I think so. I think so. And I think the simpler I keep it, the better. Mm. The more I free myself from expectations of what something must achieve with regards numbers or what the outcome must be. I think that sets up a lot of pitfalls and it kind of robs you of enjoying the moment a little bit. I think if the song, the simplest sort of cleanest approach of just, does this resonate? Does it feel worthwhile? Does it feel beautiful? If we can use that word, allow ourselves to use that word, then that has to suffice, you know.
But it is beautiful. Your new record is a journey. It's an epic journey. It's romantic. There's rock songs on there. There's romantic. It's just incredible. So we'll get into that in a moment. But did you feel some kind of pressure after the success of the first record? I mean, you must have, because you kind of came out of nowhere, right? The song was on Bandcamp, and that's kind of how people also, besides Reddit, that's how people kind of came to know it early on, right?
Yeah, I don't think I felt pressure. I didn't feel, I mean, that song charted, you know, Church. It was a big radio song and it charted. I don't think I felt pressure to repeat that success with regards its chart success or its radio success. If I felt any pressure, I felt maybe pressure that whatever music I make is, I don't know, for lack of a better word, is like useful or helpful. And that was challenging, I think. And it was an interesting time, 2016. It was like, it's funny, we keep saying, oh yeah, it felt like the world changed, or the pandemic felt like the world changed. But 2016 was an interesting time. It was like, you know, socially, you know, there was great change, and then similar as there was in 2020, you know, there was all great contextual changes. But I didn't feel a kind of, I tried to free myself from the idea that, okay, you know, that I had never began with the approach that, okay, I want to make music that is... that charts. I want to make music that resonates with people and people feel is honest and that resonates with me. But there's so many things about whether something is a hit or not a hit that is sometimes out of your control. And to me, it's more important that it feels authentic and it feels honest and it feels real and worthwhile and hopefully beautiful than whether it's a whether it's a charting hit.
Yeah, they always say, though, you have your whole life to write your first record and you have like 6 months or a year to write your second record. So yeah. What was that like for you? I mean, like I said, you did Letterman. That was your second TV appearance ever, right? Or your second appearance, I think, your second live performance.
Yeah.
I mean, that has to be crazy coming from small town Ireland and all of a sudden you're on Letterman and you're looking around and the song is starting to blow up. I mean, it had to happen so quickly for you. Most bands are slugging it out for years. They might get a deal. They may not.
Yeah.
It happened relatively quickly for you.
It did. It did. And there was definitely a challenge in that of like catching up, you know, of kind of catching up with myself, you know. And, you know, the musicians that I had around me to take with me were like, they were college friends, you know. So we were all amateurs, you know. All of us were total, like, you know, in an actual sense, in a you know, by definition, up until the point where we were okay. Here you go. So I think that it was the second time when I was performing in front of a camera lens. It was one beautiful TV event in Ireland called All Their Voices. It's like a festival that takes place in the west of Ireland. Gorgeous, gorgeous town called Dingle. Gorgeous kind of television music event and music festival. And then the second time, it was David Letterman, yeah. And I was like,
when you get that call and your label says you know you're going to be on Letterman, are you just like, this is, there's no way this is happening to me this quickly?
I think it's more, I don't even know. I can't remember what was probably going through my head. You're just in get through it mode. You're just white knuckling, you know. And it was intense, you know, that day of promo. I think we did, I don't know how many, you know, we did three performances of Take Me to Church that day before Letterman. And I think, did we do Letterman and then come to the Bowery Ballroom? So yeah, we did. Yeah. So like my voice at that point was shot. I'm kind of like I'm totally, I just haven't got my sea legs at this point, you know. And I think we did VH1, bounced around New York and Times Square, did a bunch of performances of Take Me to Church. Then we did David Letterman. I was completely ungrounded and completely without my sea legs and wasn't terribly happy with that performance. And so it was a bit crestfallen after that, knowing that that would be my last opportunity. I think David Letterman announced his upcoming retirement to play the Letterman show.
You must have been nervous.
No, I was so fucking nervous. Yeah.
Can I
curse on this?
Yeah,
that was,
curse all you want.
Absolutely was nervous. And then we did the Bowery Ballroom. But I have to say that that was the first time playing a show so far from home. And this is another reason I love New York so much, is that was the first time I stood on stage in front of a crowd of people that were not my home crowd. And I felt like I could do this for a living. And I was kind of lifted out of that feeling of dread and disappointment with myself in the performance of the Letterman performance I wasn't happy with. But and just felt like, oh wow, there's ears here that want to hear this music, and there's people are here for it, you know. And that was really encouraging,
because the record went on to do incredibly well. I think actually it was like number one in Ireland, right? It was number one in Ireland, 200, finished second on the Billboard 200s. Let's talk about some other milestones here. Definitely, I think the Grammys for you, Annie Lennox in 2015. It's got to be a highlight for you, right?
It was a good feeling. Yeah, it was. Honored to be nominated that year and to be among those performers, and also to be paired with Annie Lennox, who's somebody who I've always had such respect for. The woman is an incredible artist in the truest sense, and an icon in the truest sense. But also getting to know her a little bit over those days. She was incredibly kind, incredibly supportive, and offered me a lot of warmth and support in what was like, this kind of tumultuous time for myself, you know. But
were you a Rhythmics fan growing up?
I was, you know, I was familiar with their work. And then as you get older and you deepen your appreciation for music that was released before you were around, before you had ears to listen to it. But yeah, for sure, you know. And also, I mean, she was really bending notions of gender as well too, in a way that was like, you know, in her work.
And she was ahead of her time.
She really was. Yeah, I think so.
Then I guess 2015, let's talk about VH1 Artist of the Year. We can't not talk about the Kennedy Center Honor. So talk to me about a couple of those things that are definitely milestones in your life. Mm. And then we'll get into the new record, which is amazing, as I mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We recently did the Kennedy Honors. That was to perform kind of you know, in celebrating U2 and their Kennedy Award. That was really special. And I was glad, so glad I got to do it with them, with Brandy Carlile, who's a good friend, incredible artist, and somebody, you know, I've huge admiration for, I've huge fondness for. She's
on the new record.
She's on the new record, yeah. She's on Damn Together. Yeah, she's amazing. And
now, had you met U2 before? Did you know them? I assume it's all this like clique in Ireland where you guys are all friends, maybe not rightly so.
But yeah.
Well, is it like that or is it not like that?
It's like, well, I think myself, like, it's very rare myself and U2 kind of cross. Like, it's like we miss each other by a day or, yeah. But my first time meeting The Edge and meeting Bono was
The Edge is amazing, by the way.
He's such a wonderful nice man. Yeah, it really is such a wonderful, wonderful man. And it was before they did an event that was a kind of an anniversary event for Red and One, these two organizations that Bono works very, very closely with, and to sort of mark their achievements in the last few years, and that took place in Carnegie Hall here, and I met Bono and The Edge for the first time. I just watched their show in Dublin, and then I kind of did a quick get out before the last song, waited in the car for the guys to kind of come directly off stage and then into the car where we could begin talking about, okay, so what are we doing for Carnegie Hall? The guys are coming in, you know, still breathless, still, you know, like pouring sweat from this incredible performance. And then it's like, hey, nice to meet you. Okay, so what are we doing for Carnegie Hall? And they are...
Is there a camaraderie there with a band like that? Obviously, again, you all grew up in the same community there, but there has to be, right?
I think for all Irish artists, there is this... We're such a small island, you know, with a population that is less than that of New York, you know? What is the population of New York, you know?
God, I don't want to say 8 million, but I'm probably way off.
8 million.
I don't know.
So we're just over half
I made that,
that.
Up, but it sounds good, so...
Yeah, so we're like, Ireland is a smaller population, maybe the population of Manhattan, you know? So to see other Irish artists find audiences outside of Ireland, there's a great sense of support and pride in that. And I think... you know, we like rooting for each other, and definitely I've felt that from you too. I think the first time I did a sold out show in LA, you know, this lovely box had arrived, this beautiful bottle of whiskey or something, with this handwritten note from Bono with the
Amazing.
Little piece of he's quite an artist. He'll do his little drawings, you know. So incredibly thoughtful man, and also they live. I mean, these are guys who live the lives of two or three men. It's like,
Definitely.
It's incredible how much what their energy output is, how much they take life fully by both hands. And it's like, you know, like, I don't know. It's like they live two lives, three lives. It's incredible. How much work they do, how much activism they do, et cetera. So, yeah, but that was wonderful. So to get to, as you said, Kennedy Honors, to sing sort of celebrating them, that was special for sure.
Yeah, many years ago I had dinner with Jimmy Iovine and he said, I'm going to bring a couple friends to dinner. I said, okay, great. You know, he shows up with Bono and The Edge to dinner. I'm like, you didn't even tell me they were coming. But The Edge was amazing. I had this incredible conversation with him. I think at the time his daughter was working for Apple. So I was like prodding him for information. What's coming out next? You know, back when we had the iPod and everything was like a real huge announcement with Steve Jobs, but he's like, I can't tell you. She doesn't even tell me about what's coming out next. I'm like, please.
Yeah.
But so talk to me about, obviously, the VH1 Artist of the Year, because that's an incredible achievement too. 2015, we kind of skipped over that, but I wanted to go back to that for 1 second too.
That was cool. I think what felt good about that, I think that's a voted award, was it? Was it a voted award? Which felt really good. You know, I think when something is people just are throwing their two cents in and to get that. Yeah, and again, to get that as a foreign artist, as somebody coming in from Ireland and you know, in that first year, kind of playing in America and releasing music here in the States, and that was a special moment, I think. Yeah.
What were those early tours like for you?
You know, it's like looking back, it's some of it was white knuckling, some of it is, you know, you're experiencing things for the first time, and you're mystified by some parts of it. You're kind of, there's this wonderful, nearly romantic sense of being between worlds. You're not quite, you know, you're there for a moment and you're gone. And I think I don't know how to describe it. I think There's definitely, I will say there's moments that you feel like you're overcome with it's sort of a, there is the gratefulness and there's the enjoyment of it, but you're also overcome with the minor crisis of, well, this really has to go well. Yeah. You know, I really want to show up for this as best I can and make sure I can execute this as best I possibly can, given what I have and given whatever little experience that I have. So you're constantly just showing up to new experiences every single time on the fly, very much seat of your pants kind of thing, you know. But
did you ever feel like you should have struggled more? Like a lot of artists early on, we were touching base on that, but they struggled a lot early on in their careers. Did you ever feel like this happened too quickly, too soon for me? I mean, obviously very grateful, which is amazing, but did you ever feel like there was part of you that should have struggled more, or it should have happened like the way it happened?
Yeah, I don't want to. There's part of me that, not quite. There's part of me that doesn't want to romanticize suffering for its own sake. I feel like I sat with my work for many, many years in kind of in quiet, you know, Take Me to Church was by no means the first song I wrote, but it was the first song I released. And I will say, and this is, you know, we worked extra hard to sort of catch up with ourselves. Something that I was proud of in 2015, there's this, somebody does an aggregate, does a whole, like, counts how many miles a touring group has traveled, how many times around the world it's gone, and how many shows in a year it's done. And we were, based on that, we were the hardest working touring group of 2015.
Amazing.
Which was cool. So pound for pound, show for show, mile for mile, we worked harder than anyone else who was, I think Blue Man Group was like also in there and something. It was like,
they don't really count. They're not making original music.
But but we were, you know, so, you know, it's not like there is this kind of thing where lightning struck in some ways with the song and a video in the early moments. But everything else of bringing the songs to people. I think we would do three radio stations a week, 6 a.m., 7 a.m. starts. We would do, you know, sometimes two radio stations a day before doing a show that night. Like, it was inch by inch, mile by mile, tooth and claw type thing, you know. So I think looking back at the time, I didn't think I was working that hard. I thought everybody did it that way. And then looking back, I'm like, oh my God, if I did that now, I would die. You know, so looking back now, I get a better sense of how hard I worked, how hard we worked at that time.
Is it important for you to reset and be home and just take some time to yourself? Because you do take some time between albums, right? This new record, actually, the record comes out tomorrow, so congratulations.
Yeah,
while we sit here today, the video came out, I think, today, right?
Yeah.
And so there's an amazing, you know, there's an energy going on here. Everything's happening this week for you. But is it important for you to reset and take some time in between albums for yourself?
I think it is. I think it is. I think I'm very grateful for the home that I have and the home that I've chosen. I travel so much, bounce around the world. I have a great community in LA of creatives and friends who I've known for years. I can get great work done there. But there is a wonderful grounding that I get back home. There is a great reset that I get back home. I jump I spend a lot of time in the sea there when I can, and there's something about that. There's a restart, there's a refresh. It's also incredibly peaceful. I can kind of, you know, there's something that happens when you're on tour. There's something that happens when you release music. You're constantly seeing representations of yourself in interviews, in media, in photographs, in tweets, in TikToks, and whatever.
Forest Daddy, all kinds of TikTok
exactly,
stuff.
Exactly. Right. And it's great. It's wonderful. But you're constantly seeing these kind of reflections of yourself that aren't, you know, that here, this is me,
right?
You know, here I am. And
do you relate more to Andrew or Hozier? I mean, what relates? I mean, who are you really? Honestly, I feel like Hozier is your pseudonym, but ultimately I think Andrew is just, you like to be referred to as Andrew.
Yeah.
Right? That's really more you.
I would introduce myself as Andrew, I think. But what's funny about that is that there was two Andrews in my class. There's a wonderful friend of mine, Andrew. I don't know if I should give him names. I don't want people searching my buddies. But it's like, so one of my best friends is another Andrew. And so his nickname was his second name, and my nickname was my second name. So I was always Hosier in high school. Hosier was my nickname since I was maybe 12. So what's funny is I have this very small group of friends from back home who they're Andrew. Like they're the person to them is Hosier, yeah. Not the artist. If
really?
That makes sense. Yeah. And so it's funny. It's like
your high school friends still call you Andrew, I'm sure, right?
No, they all call me Hosier.
Oh, they do.
Because
okay.
my high school nickname was Hosier.
Okay, so they're used to calling you that.
They're used to call me Hosier. Yeah. So it's a funny mix of things, but I think it just seems a little bit silly referring to myself. You know what I mean?
It's like here's it's like a third person.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, talk to me. There's been a 4-year break between this latest record that comes out tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I think by the time you listen to this, the record will be out for about a week or so. But talk to me. Was it important for you to take that long in between records just to reset like we spoke about?
Yeah. Some of it is, you know what? Some of it is, I'd actually started with a few songs on the road that I thought would be the beginnings of the next record, of this third record. Some of it is that it's difficult to write on the road. It's difficult to get the headspace to kind of forge the idea to cultivate the space in which the intention and the motive and the whatever the feeling of what you want to capture in the next body of work is while you're touring. And I think we toured the first one for just over 2 years, toured the second album for 2 years. So it's kind of gaining that space again to go, okay, where am I now? Like, who am I now? And where am I now? And then in 2020, I think I'd started with some songs, I did record at the end of the last tour. And in 2020, it just felt like the world kind of changed and context changed.
And those songs no longer resonated with you when the pandemic started to begin because you thought they're not relevant to what's going on in my life at this point, right?
A little bit, yeah. A little bit. I felt like there was this great sea change, which I felt carried along with, you know. And so I kind of started with a lot of new music in 2020. And, you know, there was a very quiet time. I got a lot of ideas down. I started a lot of ideas, but couldn't really travel anywhere to work with. There was a few producers I wanted to work with. It was quite challenging to work with them. So it wasn't until really the beginning of 2022, end of 21, beginning of 22, that let's say the borders in the States kind of opened up again. You could reapply for your visa and then kind of come in legitimately and work in a studio setting. So the ideas were there. There was kind of stew that was cooking. And then 22, I kind of came in and hit the ground running. And it was an intensely creative time. And then started jamming when I was like started working on new music at the same time. Ended up writing and recording altogether enough material for two albums. And so that was a challenge also. Was okay, where do we pair this back and where do we decide what is worth going on this album and what do we share if we share later on?
Yeah, I never thought I'd be so grateful just to be in a room with people and just create music or whatever it may be. And at that point, we were literally thinking, we touch a tree, we could die. We have to wipe down our cereal boxes and apples, right?
Right.
And to think about it then, we were really all going through it. So obviously the music took on a new meaning for you. But at this point, so you go to LA, you start to record vocals. I think you rent an Airbnb, right?
I was in and out of Airbnbs. I was kind of, something I enjoyed about that was like, I could do a month in one part of town, month in another part of town, you know?
Where'd you go? You were like in Silver Lake and Venice and all over LA, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, Abbotkinney and Silver Lake, Echo Park, some time in Studio City, some time in West Hollywood, you know.
Nobody really works in LA, do they? I mean, they work in the music business, but mm-hmm. aside from that, and obviously the film business, a lot of people don't work in LA. It's a strange culture out there, right?
It took me a long time, and part of it until I had a community there of friends that I was like able to see maybe once a week or something like that. It's like, it took me a while to make sense of the flow of life and the pace of life in LA, for sure. Because I was traveling there 7 years, 8 years, promoting music. I'd be in for a few days or maybe a week, and then I'd be gone again.
But it's funny, when you come to New York, there's no one here that doesn't work. If you go to LA and you ask your friends, what are you doing today? Nothing much, because no one's really busy. It's like, again, if you're in the music industry or the film industry, but for some reason, there's a lot of people with a lot of leisure time in LA. In New York, yeah, everyone's on the hustle.
That's interesting.
So I'm sure you had a lot of friends in LA, right? You probably have a great community there that you built this record around.
Yeah, I had some friends who I went to college with who kind of came, who were then working in LA at the time. And they were working. But but you,
there's a handful of people working there, for sure.
But it's funny. It's like, but definitely New York, any of my Irish buddies that come over, there'd be like two or three jobs. Right. You know what I mean? Yeah. And it's, this is...
Yeah, you have to hustle to be here.
You hustle, yeah, yeah. You really earn your keep to be in New York. Yeah,
definitely.
For sure.
Well, let's talk about the incredible new record, Unreal on Earth, just coming out tomorrow as we sit here today. There's some great music on this. You put out an EP not long ago, so a bunch of the songs that are on the new record have previously come out. Some of my favorite songs, obviously, I want to kind of break it down a little bit. So, The Selby, the video came out, actually, I think it came out today, right? Or yesterday?
Yeah, video with incredible Irish actor Donal Gleeson. So Donal is... I've known him a couple of years. I got to know him, I think, through my manager and through some actor friends.
I mentioned to you he was on my favorite episode of Black Mirror.
Yes.
People don't know that.
There's this, it's excellent. And if you haven't watched Black Mirror, Black Mirror is, it's fantastic.
Because in Ireland, he's like a god. I mean, everybody knows him there.
Donal Gleeson. I got to share this with him when I was kind of in my late teens. He had done a run of comedy, like a comedy sketch show back in Ireland. And some of it he would do like for charity also. I think there was like this charity comedy sketch thing that he did. I think it was called Your Bad Self. And he has such a natural humor. He's a very natural warmth and kindness to him. But he's incredibly funny, incredibly, like, he's scalpel sharp. Like, he's so, so quick and so funny. I wasn't there at the shoot for this video, but we spoke, myself and then Wolf James is the director, Debbie. We got on a few phone calls and talked about the treatment, shared ideas, shared images. And
by the way, if you watch it, it's about him digging his own grave.
Ultimately. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No spoilers, but yeah, he's kind of, you know, we're trying to get this kind of loop, this kind of loop thing going, this kind of cyclical thing. It kind of nods to elements of Third Policeman, and which DeSalby is a character in. But the performance is just stunning. Like he is. And every time I see him, there's another color, there's another note to his kind of arsenal that he sort of unleashes. But in this, I was just astounded by how much ground he covers in that character in that video. But he gave it everything, and the concept also was kind of started with Donal. In the early conversations of that video, he was like, "Okay, so here's what I'm seeing," and it was, What about this dude with a shovel? And we kind of rolled from there. And
you're like, that's kind of morbid, or this is brilliant.
I love it. Yeah, yeah. I was like, yeah, no, that's right up my street. I'm really proud of that video. I think he's a remarkable actor, and I was really proud to work with him. I'm a fan of Donal Gleeson as well. Yeah. Like I've been a fan for a long time. So there's that part of me that kind of dorks out about it. You know?
Well, the whole record kind of references Dante's Inferno, right? It's like nine different, you know, if you go back to that poem from years ago, talk to me about Dante's Inferno, and it's not an exact it's a reference, but ultimately you sort of use that as inspiration for the record, right? 16 tracks.
Yeah, yeah. Here's this poem about a guy who finds his way into new circumstances, new strange and dark circumstances, and then walks his way through it until he comes out the other side, you know? It felt like in the last few years, it felt wrong not to come out of the last 3 years of a pandemic and not acknowledge in some way. And there's part of me that's absolutely allergic to writing songs that focus too much on the lockdown experience or the pandemic experience.
None of those pandemic records did well, by the way. You have to just say, like, this is just a record, right?
It's kind of, you know, yeah, I think we all lived it. We all made sense of it in our own way, and we all came out the other side our own way. And I think that's what I just wanted to nod to in having a structure of an album that has a descent at the beginning that follows this path, that nods to this path of through circles that Dante outlines in this poem, it's also a poem that I was kind of reading in the pandemic when I had the time, and I just resonated with some of the themes, some of the language in it. but he comes out the other side. One thing that he writes at the top of the doorway, that famous quote of abandon all hope, ye who enter here, is like well remembered as what he writes. But that's a larger passage. And one of the early lines in that is through me you enter into the population of loss. And it just seemed like there was so much in those early few months of the pandemic, there was so much that was potentially hung in over us with regards loss. People had loved ones they could lose, the jobs that disintegrated. There was a way of life disintegrated. The context for the way we had been socializing, our understanding of socializing, the simplest of social interactions, physical contact, totally changed. So much was potentially, I think, hanging over in the air with regards to this idea of loss. Lives that were being lost at the time, number cases just being reported constantly. And there was something surreal about that. So it did feel strange to just come out of that period and not acknowledge something of a journey through that period of time.
Yeah. I think everyone's perspective on life changed after that, for sure. I mean, one of my favorite songs, by the way, on the record, Francesca, has a bit of a dark story behind it. So talk to me about the meaning behind that song.
Yeah. Francesca, yeah, which is a kind of more of a direct reference to the text. There's a character in it called Francesca de Rimini, and she's a historical figure from Florence that Dante writes that he recognizes. He comes across this hurricane, and which is just full of souls. It's just constant, like, it's a hurricane. He calls, I think in the translation I read, that this group of people, this enormous group of people oppressed by black air, they're being tossed around in this very, very dark space forever for having been swept off their feet in real life. But Francesca is among them, is this real historical figure. But it's kind of, she died under circumstances that, like, she was murdered for falling in love with somebody. And that song kind of tries to do two things. It's me sort of, you know, it's my own personal reflections and something that I wrote regarding somebody who was very close to me at the time and things that they were going through. But then also it's kind of seeks to ameliorate or sort of undermine this idea that somebody would be punished for that. Mm. To sort of write from an empathetic point of view and say, well, no, actually, this is a choice I made to love this person, and I won't be punished for it. This is actually being with this person for eternity is the best thing that could ever happen. So trying to sort of turn that punishment on its head a little bit.
Yeah, and talk to me about, again, the reference of the poem, because not every song on the record is referencing that. A lot of it just comes from personal experiences, and then use that as sort of a template for the record.
Yeah. So in the poem, you know, he arranges hell into circles. So the songs, if sometimes they might nod to the imagery or some elements that are specific to the poem, but either way, they definitely will resonate with one of those circles. So if it's the circle of wrath or the circle of greed or gluttony, the song will be like Eat Your Young represents the circle of gluttony. So there is that. And there's no, not that I know of. Actually, there is, I think there's a character further on in circle 9 where there's a father who ate his child, and I think he's in the but each
we won't talk about that
but each young, yeah, just nods to this idea of gluttony, and then this idea of greed, this idea of wrath, whatever, this idea of heresy, and all of these feelings, all of these themes, so that in that way it sometimes resonates like that. Francesca's a direct reference, there's some indirect references here and there, but yeah, so I guess that's how it took shape, how it took form.
And you got to work with the amazing Brandi Carlile. We were just talking about that, but Damage Gets Done. Like, when did you connect with her? What was that like working with her?
I've known
she's a force.
She is a force. She's an absolute force. incredible artist. Somebody whose work I admire. There's such courage in her work. In the spaces she cultivates such a space of warmth and celebration and inclusion in everything that she does and in honoring artists that should, and it's important to honor, I think, you know, with regards to Joni and Joni Mitchell, and she invited me into one of the very early Joni jams back in LA. she was like, hey, would you want to have dinner at Joni Mitchell's house? And I was like, yeah, let me just book a flight. I think we're in Texas.
I think I'm around for that.
I think I can fly 1,000 miles. But, you know, and
what's Joni Mitchell like now when you meet her?
I haven't met Joni for since that evening. But she was wonderful. She was very talkative. She was, she shared a great deal of. We played. That was a really surreal night. It was like, Brandy was like, hey, we're just going to have dinner and you know,
At Joni Mitchell's house.
And you know, I get the impression she's kind of said that she just misses having music around and people playing music. So it would be cool to bring that into the space. And it'd be cool. That's what I say about Brandy creating spaces that are, that people thrive in, people feel good in, people feel welcome in and included in. And she works from this place of love and in this very open-armed sort of place. And so it was like this very simple thing of like, let's just play music and see what happens. And like, you know, just brought a guitar. And then I think I arrived in that day, we were on the way to the house. And she was like, oh yeah, by the way, I think Herbie Hancock is coming. I think Chaka Khan is coming. They're all, you know, so
play like, a concert somewhere.
Yeah, it was nuts.
Did you have a mentor ever? Because I feel like Joni was Brandy's mentor in a sense. Do you have a mentor that you look up to or that you worked with early on?
No one that I worked with early on. I think if there was mentors, there's definitely a few people I was blessed with, you know, family and friends who offered me good advice early on or gave me the tools. You know, one of my first electric guitar was given to me by an uncle. My first DAW, my first interface, audio interface was given to me by another uncle who was like, just do it, you know, just do it yourself. You know, you don't need somebody else, wait on somebody else's skills, because ultimately you'll be unhappy with it. Like, you know, figure out how to make the thing that you feel represents you and make it. And I think, you know, I had an uncle who invested in me in that way. He sort of gave me my first little like Yamaha interface, and I ended up recording some of my first demos on that.
Was he a musician?
No. He had some history of doing some stuff maybe with A&R when he was younger. And he was really, really interested in music. That's one of my uncles. My other uncle is a musician. Yeah. And I still play some of his guitars on stage. Amazing. I still tour with this Dan Electro, this Stratocaster, all of this stuff that he very generously gave to me, you know, years and years ago when I was still a teenager, that are still part of my sort of musical arsenal. So I had people around me who supported me and gave me license to do what I could do, you know, or to open up my potential a little bit, you know.
You've already toured a bit for this new record, by the way. You just got back. Are you playing the songs live? What seems to be connecting with people live on this new record?
What seems to be connecting? It's crazy.
I feel like Unknown is definitely connecting
Unknown
with
is something
people.
Connected. Yeah. I was gonna say it was that, again, talking about just sharing something that was like getting a demo down and sharing it. I think I shared it on TikTok. That is one of the amazing things about the kind of a system like that, is you can just like, hey, here is something I have done. Here is a song that I think is cool, or a snippet or an idea that I think is cool, and it's nascent, and it's maybe embryonic. It's still early, and people can tell you immediately. You don't have to go into studio. You don't have to come up with a plan for it. It's just like, hey, here's a thing that I think is cool. And it's direct. You've direct access to people who are like, this is sweet. We love it. And that put wind in my sails for that song. So by the time that I was playing it live, it's like people know this song already. They've sat with it for months, you know, long before it was ever even recorded in a studio.
I love your connection with the fans, by the way. You even went to Brighton not long ago, and you were like busking in the street there. I'm sure when people showed up there and they heard you singing, they must have been like, there's no way that Hozier's singing. Take me to church in the street in Brighton.
Yeah, that was fun. We had a good turnout. It was absolutely torrential. It was the torrential rain at the moment, and it was Brighton Pride, you know. So I think we let people know a couple hours earlier that day. We were like, hey, meet us at the pavilion. We had a little bit of a place to sing underneath, but it was a good turnout, you know. I think doing stuff like that, it is in a way, it's a little bit of a reset. You know, you're just yourself again. playing music in a way that is you've done since you were a kid. There's no conceit. There's no conceit of a show. You know, it's just like, here's a person with a guitar. They're just singing a song, and this isn't a show. This isn't a performance. It's not even. There's no barrier, energetically or physically, between yourself and the audience. And that, if that makes sense, you're just standing in space, and people are right around you, and you're just singing a song. There's something really nice about that. It's an interaction, you know, rather than a transaction, you know.
Do you prefer those intimate shows? Because you're actually playing like Madison Square Garden here. You're playing some incredible shows. The Hollywood Bowl, all sold out, by the way. So congrats on that.
Thank you.
You prefer those intimate shows, or do you prefer the bigger shows?
I think I love them. I missed them for a long time. So when we came around, we did the Bowery again recently. We did the Bowery Ballroom. We did like the Troubadour. We just did a tour for the last few months. We've just been touring club shows. And I was really getting a great sense of that, this kind of conversational, something that feels like it's like a little secret party that we're all having. You know, it's 400 people. The energy is so focused.
Way different than like Glastonbury, where there's like 100,000 people out there and you can't even see anyone. It's
totally.
Just a sea of faces. Right?
Yeah. Then you're singing to a concept, the conceptual crowd.
Yeah.
Rather than a group of people, you know. I suppose there's different ways you can sort of make sense of it, but there is... The crowd itself becomes something else, you know. But but I'm ready. I think, having done so many club shows this year, I'm ready to sort of to do the other thing. I'm ready to come and do some bigger shows again, you know.
Awesome. And there's I'd be hard pressed not to mention, you know, the fact that Sinead O'Connor died recently. And I think that you've found out, maybe when you were on stage, you did a great tribute to her. What did she mean to you, and her impact being Irish and on the music community? Actually, I saw something that was fairly interesting, saying, you know, it's okay to celebrate people when they're alive. You know, it seems like so many people came out of the woodwork to celebrate her after she died, but I don't feel like she was as celebrated the last few years. And it's sad, because honestly, an incredible artist.
Yeah. 100%. I think all too often we take for granted the existence of somebody, and then we're having to measure how much has been lost, or having to measure how much of an empty space now we have on our hands, that we have in our sort of collective field, you know. Where did this, and so within the case of Sinead, it just felt like that day, like there was in our collective field, certainly in Ireland, here was this incredible force, this creative force, this force that had such clarity in their moral vision, in their moral courage, very unapologetic in their vision, and a absolute searing, like needle sharp artist, and a brilliant artist. And this was this kind of force that sat with us. And I think we took for granted that we might be the beneficiaries of for decades to come, and to lose her at that young age. To bring it back to Brandi Carlile, somebody again who, you know, something I admire about Brandi is she makes efforts to celebrate artists while we have them. And it is so important. But in the case of Sinead, and I have to reckon with the fact that I'm kind of walking roads that in many ways she paved, and she paved at great cost.
Definitely.
So the sensibilities, she rattled people's sensibilities quite a bit with confronting the questions that she confronted. You look back and she was never wrong. You know, she was never wrong about her observations, especially with regards church abuses. But the sort of collective inability or cowardice or discomfort with approaching those questions, looking at them with courage, looking at them with honesty, looking at them with the stomach that was needed to look at them. When people don't have that collectively, they oftentimes, you know, the person who brings up the question could pay the price. She paid in great scrutiny and great criticism for her observations. And I think, those roads that she kind of paved, I'm kind of walking and thriving on now. And so I do owe her a great deal as an artist, you know, I really do.
Yeah, I feel like there's so many artists from Ireland that have depth. Every artist from there has a great sense of depth and meaning. And unlike a lot of other artists today, where there's a story and there's a lot of integrity there. So you're right, she paved the way. And She'll be missed for sure. So we do this really fun thing at the end of the show where we talk about your top five lists and some things I want to get into for you. So I want to talk to you about the top five Irish acts ever for you.
Christ. I can't believe that.
Starting with number five.
Oh, no, I can't. Well, I can't. I don't know. This is like straight up, right on the, right. Okay, right. You put me on my toes. Okay, in no order. Like, I can't do it in order because that would be crazy. But I have to include, Phil Lynott comes into this. So I'm including Thin Lizzy because...
One of my favorite bands of all time.
No way.
Yes, yeah. Underrated.
I got it just because Phil is a Dubliner. And he was it was a big one. One of the first albums I was ever given. I was given an album by my dad, their Live and Dangerous album.
Yeah, which, great record.
Great record.
Yeah.
So for me, Thin Lizzy, Phil Lynott, has a charismatic rock and roll force as a writer. Yeah, incredible. I have to say, as a, you know, for the sort of the guitar kid in me, you know, being into like Jimi Hendrix and Rory Gallagher has to be in that top five, I think. So
another underrated artist, by the way.
Yeah, I think so.
Just a lot of people don't know him here.
Yeah, he's incredible blues guitarist and rock and roll guitarist. And he just, it's like not even that he was this amazing electric guitarist. He'd pull out a mandolin and then just fucking shred on that thing. He'd pull out an acoustic guitar and then pull out a slide. He would shred on that thing. He was like, he's like Ireland's Dwayne Allman, you know what I mean? So I think Rory Gallagher, yeah, he would have to be on this list.
Number three.
For me, just based on influence, the influence that his work has had on me, Astral Weeks, etc., the Moondance album. Van Morrison was for me a very, very influential artist, and I have to credit that.
I have to be honest, until I researched this, I didn't even know he was Irish. I had no idea.
He's from Northern Ireland. He's from Northern Ireland.
I didn't know.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, he's from Northern Ireland, and you can kind of hear it a little bit in his singing. Sometimes he has that voice. I think. This is so tough to do it five, because there's like, I don't even know if I can, like, if I'm going to be able to fit in the Pogues into this and Shane McGowan. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to fit in, like, I mean, U2 has to come into this.
Well, we're at number two. So your number two would be?
It would be, okay. I think Sinead has to come in. I think Sinead has to come in here. This is really tough. Is this for me, my list, or just what I think are the top five?
This is what you think.
This is not okay. So we're going to do the top seven. I have to give a special mention to the Cranberries and how influential Dolores O'Riordan, her voice as an instrument. When I'm hearing that for the first time, I'm going, oh, you can sing like that? Like, she opens up her accent. She opens up the natural sort of glottal leaps in her voice. So the Cranberries are an incredibly special band to me. Sinead O'Connor, incredibly, like a remarkable artist. U2, their achievement is just astounding. U2's achievement is absolutely astounding. And what Bono in particular has done in sort of like trying to cancel global debt is amazing. And I think it's going to be hard to quantify the result of all of the incredible work that he's done in funding like malaria treatment, etc., and trying to abolish malaria. You know, that's incredible. And trying to cancel global debt, that's incredible.
Would they be your number two?
I don't know. I can't give you a solid five. I think they would maybe be. They'd nearly have to be number one, I think, just for what they've achieved globally. But
and number two being the Cranberries.
I don't know. They can't put me in this position. So there's Sinead, there's the Pogues. Paul Brady is another hugely influential artist for me. If people are interested in traditional music, get into the Bahi Band or Planxty, get into Moving Hearts. But Paul Brady, I think, for his playing in open tunings and listening to him playing like Mary and the Soldier and Arthur McBride, he opened in me an interest in writing more in open tuning. So he's another artist that I think. Christ, there's too many. There's too many.
There's a lot. Well, this one's going to be extra hard too, because a lot of people say you have one of the best voices in, you know, iconic voices out there in music today. So my next list for you is the top five greatest voices in music today, starting with number five. We would put you on the list, but this is people other than you.
Thank you. Top five greatest voices. I think for vocal ability, I'm always astounded by Yebba. Her voice, that is an instrument. I'm always astounded by Brandy. I think R&B is always this place where, as an instrument, it's like, it's kind of like saying, okay, who's the best saxophonist ever? And you don't look at jazz. You know what I mean? I think if you're looking at voices and you're not looking at R&B and soul music, it's hard, you know, it seems silly. So
number three for you?
Yeah. Aretha Franklin, I think, greatest ever vocalist to have lived. I still hear phrases, the way that she attacks phrases, the way she lets go of phrases, the way she times. She's behind the beat. The feel of her approach astounds me still. So Aretha Franklin, Ella Fitzgerald. Yeah. Okay. Ella Fitzgerald is maybe number one. Billie Holiday was a huge voice for me. Otis Redding was a huge voice for me.
I think we skipped over two, but we can insert one of those in number two.
I'm sorry. I can't give a solid five. And then a voice I listened to again. I went back to an old favorite, Wild as the Wind by Nina Simone. And for what is carried in a voice, because it's like hard to describe why a voice is, because you don't need to have a pretty voice or a technically sound voice for a voice to be remarkable. I think I kind of reject this notion that I think for me, sometimes the more perfect voice is, in that sort of, there's different ways of approaching it. But what you carry in a voice, when I hear Nina Simone sing like Wild as the Wind, that to me, it's like, that does it for me.
Amazing. Well, great list, by the way.
Thank you.
Definitely. So the tour is coming up September 9th, St. Louis. You excited for it?
I am so excited for it. We're playing some really iconic venues I haven't played before. Yeah, so I am.
Where are you excited to play besides MSG, the Hollywood Bowl?
Hollywood Bowl. I'm excited to go back to Red Rocks and sort of...
One of the greatest venues ever, by the way. I got to play there. It was incredible.
No way. Yeah. It's beautiful. Yeah. Did you get the altitude?
They give you like an oxygen tank and they put it next to you, which is weird because, but it was incredible. And you'll have an amazing show there, I'm sure. Yeah. Super excited. Check out the new record, Unreal Unearthed, just came out. Today.
Yes, thank you
or
very
tomorrow,
much.
Actually.
Yes.
I look forward to everything. I look forward to seeing you here in New York or LA.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming in. You're a pleasure.
It was a joy.
I could do this for hours, but I know we don't have hours. So thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Hope to see you soon.
You too.
You're listening to Lips LA with Scott Lips.
Well, that was awesome. What an epic guy. Amazing conversation. I could talk to him for hours. If you like the show, please make sure you tell a few friends about the show. The show is available on YouTube. Please leave us a review. 5 stars would be great. It's available everywhere, Spotify, iTunes, anywhere that you get your shows. Theme music by Robbie Hoffman. Check out Hozier on tour. He's everywhere. The new record just out. The new video just out. Check him out on all forms of social media. Thank you for tuning in and speak to you soon.